episode of Confident ROI, the one show you can listen to confidently to get a real return on your investment. Whether you work in the business, work on the business, or work with other businesses, from the man who's done all three, Alex Vorobyev. Hey, Alex.
Hey, Paul.
All right. So we're off and ready and running. You're down here at our Southern Command here. How's it looking today?
Weather's good. No sign of any Canadians here in the southern border.
Okay. All right. Well, we got to keep asking because, you know, not many people are checking these things.
It's a situation that we're continuing to monitor.
Okay. All right. Good. Well, who are we gonna help us monitor with today here?
Well, we got a really interesting guest today. I saw him at a USC Technology and Innovation conference where a friend of mine, David Savowitz, was also on the same panel, but David hasn't been on the show yet. But Brian Dolan is joining us, who is a data scientist, and he's worked with some amazing organizations helping do magic tricks with data to find the nuggets inside of the data. He does some really interesting things down. I'll let him explain to him, but imagine being able to take physicians' notes that are messily written.
Indecipherable.
They call it unstructured data. And they're able to harness that data. He's done things where they're able to harness that data. So we've heard a lot about in the media about artificial intelligence and big data. And I like to think I kind of understand this stuff, and I do stuff with data and do analysis, but it goes over my head, and Brian's really good at explaining it and sharing some stories about how organizations are using it. So, Brian, are you there?
I am indeed.
Brian, why don't you elaborate on how a layperson, I probably butchered some things in data analysis and data scientist, why don't you fill out the introduction?
Yeah, sure. So I heard in your bump that you can listen confidently to this show. So my challenge now, of course, is to speak confidently on the show. hopefully I can pull that part off. So I'm a mathematician. And, you know, recently the title, I say recently because I've been in this field for a long time, has become data scientist. That's like the title that people like to use. When I was in graduate school, a million years ago, being called a data miner was an insult. It was like, that guy's a data miner. He doesn't do good science. But it's now a sort of a thing. So I'm still sort of adjusting. That's how old I am, by the way. And I also like to call myself a cyberneticist because that was my original sort of background. But I won't go into the details there. Unless that piques your interest, we can talk about why cybernetics. But what I've done throughout my career has been primarily based on huge amounts of data in a business context, so primarily enterprise data. I was a director of research at Fox MySpace for a number of years, and where that sounds very media, the data we were dealing with was largely enterprise-oriented data. I did a lot of different things with the hyper-targeting team. Arnie Singe and John Carnahan invented all the hyper-targeting back then. I moved on from there. I worked a lot with, and I can say this now, worked a lot with CIA, doing text mining for them, and we had some really interesting wins there. I've wandered around a bit, working with some other Fortune 100 companies, sort of doing analytics on demand as a consultant. And my most recent company that just left was DeepSix AI, which does the clinical records you were mentioning, where we were looking at the text within physician notes and trying to determine things about patients so we can match them to clinical trials. And that was a particularly satisfying challenge because if we match somebody to a clinical trial, we can actually save their life. And we did have many instances where, for instance, one not too long ago, where we matched 12 to 15 juveniles with a heart condition to a trial that significantly improved their lives. And so when you do that, when you get up in the morning and that's the end of your day, it's a particularly satisfying day.
Brian, that's a great story there. So literally, you guys doing the analysis on data, you're able to save people's lives. It pops up and makes correlations and says you need to talk to this person.
In essence, yes. So in the clinical trials space, one of the things that prevents drugs from getting to market is they can't find the right patients to test their drugs on. So if you have a drug or treatment or whatever it is, some sort of schedule to improve health, you can't find the right patients. And the problem has been, you know, since time immemorial, that you don't know where the information about that patient is. So if a patient has a very subtle sort of heart condition, it doesn't really make it into the EHR for a variety of reasons.
So the EHR being
the electronic health records. There's a big push for all medical records to be digital now. That doesn't mean that it's clear that this person has a particular kind of heart condition in the record itself. It's just written out as text by the physician. He'll be typing up notes as he talks to the patient and decide, you know, diagnose this particular condition. So even though it's in electronic format, it is not retrievable electronically without a fair amount of natural language processing on top of it. And so what we do is we do that NLP, or we did that NLP, and we identified these subtle conditions, and we were able to turn around to people who had trials open, people who were trying to test a drug and say, does anybody need a patient that looks like this? And that was a very valuable service, you know, partially to pharma, partially to researchers, lots to universities who were studying particular conditions. They need to go out and find those patients.
So you kind of reversed the – typically the companies are looking for people that fit a profile, and you changed it where the profile is now – you're now – giving profiles. Is anyone looking for a profile like this?
In a way, yeah. And it's, you know, that's been a trend in my career. I was at, like I said, I was at MySpace. So we would read through all the profiles and we'd say, oh, this person's into NASCAR, or that person's wants to get married. So we'd send like a wedding or an engagement ring ad to the boyfriend of a woman we decided wanted to get married. That was particularly successful. We do things like that at MySpace. And then I moved on from there. I was working in the government space, where we were looking at communities of, you know, of people within text, where you'd get a couple of, millions and millions of documents and say, oh, this person met that person in that city, and we would be able to find out where these communities are, who's talking to who, and about what. And then, you know, those are two very different use cases with similar technologies. So when we had the opportunity to do this in the clinical trial space, it was like the technology, I'd already built all that technology up, so it was easy to sort of transfer from, I'm going to go find people who want NASCAR, or I'm going to go find a group of people who might be talking about, you know, brown sodas, and then move that over to, I'm going to find a group of people who have a very subtle medical condition, and somebody is looking for those people with a medical condition. So it was the next evolution was doing the matching between what groups exist and what the groups are looking for, because they wouldn't often express it in exactly the same language. You know, that's part of the thing. You tell me what you're looking for, I tell you what I have. If we're using different language, you got a mismatch there.
Yeah, so it's one thing, like, there's a field. Hey, this person likes NASCAR. Well, we're going to send them some ads that would be relevant to that interest. But what happens when there is no field that's clear? And how do you know the person likes, I think you said, brown soda? How do you know that?
Yeah, you know.
Or how do you figure that out from the data?
Yeah, there's a million ways to do that. And, you know, there's some fairly standard ways. You can go and download Python packages. You can use NLTK, and they will give you sort of sentence parsing utilities. But honestly, I found in my own research, we use some of this at DeepSix, that a lot of times it's much simpler if you reverse the question, and if you go into a question, if you go into the record with a question, and this is something I've done throughout my career, rather than saying, I'm going to read, you know, your diary, and I'm going to tell you everything about your diary, I go in and I say, has Alex blogged at all about brown soda recently? And if I go in with a question, then I can use a lot of much simpler methods. If I'm doing a general question, I have to come up with a sort of an abstract view of your whole diary and everything you've done. But if I have a specific question, then everything becomes simpler, including, like, one of my favorite tricks is I like to use proximity search in smaller text. So what does that mean? So I go into your diary, I look for mentions of the word brown soda. And now, if you're talking about brown and soda, if those two words show up, if they're close, they're probably related. And then if the word hate or love is close, in, you know, proximal to those words in your text, then they're probably related. it's not perfect. It doesn't work in an abstract sense. You can't do that in an abstract sense because you have too many ideas to manage. But if you're really going in there sort of with a question, it works particularly well. And that particular fact is why most of the time when you see people doing sentiment mining or sentiment analysis, all of their examples are on Twitter or movie reviews, because they've limited the context to like short form text so that you can find out exactly what they're talking about. You don't see sentiment mining being done on novels because there's just too many contexts to navigate. So when you reverse the question, you say, this is my target, this is the question I want to know, you can simplify all the math terrifically and get actually much better results. And I want to pile on that one. This was a trick worked with, a million years ago when I was in graduate school and I was TAing at UCLA, and I would tell students who were studying for the final exam, like, start at the back of the book, because if you start at chapter 9, chapter 9 is going to assume knowledge of chapter 8. So now you're going back into chapter 8 with a question to answer a specific need, and you'll learn it better. So I've been using that sort of trick in industry quite a bit. Going with a specific need, it simplifies the range of things you have to consider, and you can get to a much more accurate answer pretty quickly. That was a really long-winded answer.
It was right on. So is it, when you, as you describe the you're analyzing where words are together, is it almost like how they broke originally the codes in cryptology in terms of they looked at relationships between letters and where they were and tried to find the patterns?
Yeah, so there are sequential patterns and there are sort of non-sequential patterns. And so in cryptographic systems, it's usually some sort of cryptographic pattern. Sequential pattern. So in words, you can say, I hate everything that is brown soda. And then the hate, is in front. And so it's sort of a non-sequential modifier. Or you say, brown soda is something I absolutely hate. It can come before or after. So you have sort of what you would describe as a radial method, right? Like you find your target, brown soda. You find a radius around it in the text. And you look for modifiers there. With cryptography, because of the nature of the beast, it's highly sequential. You have to know that this pattern happens after that pattern. The interesting sort of analogy in biology to that is genetics, because the sequence of transcription in a genome is extremely important. So there's been a lot of good overlap between computational biology and cryptography in terms of we use these methods that walk along a string or walk along a series of bits, keep in mind their history of where they've been walking, and that leads them to the answer. So if it's, if it's G-A-G-A, that's different than G-G-A-G-A in terms of what's going to be transcribed. And it's a very simple example, obviously. So with the cryptography, one of the things that has, cipher decryption, one of the things that's been interesting to see is how people are using this technique called reinforcement learning to try to also break these cryptographic systems, not necessarily the security systems that we're seeing right now, because those operate in a slightly different way. But reinforcement learning is one of these things where you can put in a sequence with a reward at the end, and if the system learns to get to the reward and doesn't give up, it can learn some very complicated behavior, and that was what was behind the Atari win. I don't know if you guys know. Well, let me summarize that. So I guess it was a year and a half ago, there was a big announcement that a computer had beaten all these video games by simply watching the screen, which was true. It's not, believe it or not, that was not hype, like so much in artificial intelligence. That was not hype. It's slightly different than what they say, but not different in any substantial way. But the idea was you can get the computer to run a bunch of random patterns, and it learns that if it runs a particular sequence, it gets a reward, and in that case, it was a high score. And one of the things it was doing was trying to move the paddle on Pong, for instance. So I move it up or move it down, depending on how the screen looks, I can get a high score. So that reinforcement learning is a pretty powerful technique. It's probably the hottest technique out there right now. And it can be used, it's being used in genetics, although I haven't seen any really big successes there. I've just seen some interesting stuff.
But is that AI, Brian?
Yeah, that really is. And, you know, working definitions of AI are hard to come by. It depends on who's doing the PowerPoint. But that,
that's what, the power of the PowerPoint. It's not right. Who has the gold, but who does the PowerPoint.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I used to like to say the last mile of data is PowerPoint. Because it all gets boiled down. I would do these month-long analyses and put it into one slide, you know, at the end of a deck. But that truly is AI because you have taught this system to make decisions on its own. And my working definition is often, can you get the computer to infer an answer that it was not previously given? So that's the big difference between that and BI, where it's like, hey, what was the temperature yesterday? Well, that's in a database. You just look it up. That's BI. I'm not saying it's trivial, but like conceptually, mathematically, it is trivial. Technologically, it's still very hard in many cases. If you can get the computer to say something as simple as, hey, it's hot today, will it be hot tomorrow? That is the computer making a decision from data that where it doesn't already have the answer. And so I would argue that that is a potential for the definition of artificial intelligence.
All right. Well, we're going to take a little break here, and then we'll finish up on AI and then talk about some magic tricks with data.
Absolutely.
Well, we're going to take a little break to give you some more data, and that is that there's a magazine out now filled with information, filled with data, so you can discover the right tool to improve your company. Yes, it's finally here, that handbook you've been looking for, that one guide that takes you through all the different strategies and tools being thrown at you daily here. For example, you can learn how to unleash your inner supercomputer in this month's issue of Confident ROI. You can also learn about the EOS traction system, the blind spot remover, or even learn more from Vern Harnish on strategy. All that and more is in the new issue of Confident ROI magazine. And we're so confident you like it, we're giving it to you for free. That's right, ConfidentROI.com. Go there, learn more, download the magazine. And be confident that you're taking a look at all the tools and the right ones for your company. ConfidentROI.com. All right. The only thing I'm confident about right now is that this conversation is going to continue to be interesting here. I can't believe some of the things you guys are talking about here. So I'm going to just shut up and listen for more here.
Well, we're going to have to see if the computers analyze it and they decide if we're interesting or not.
Yeah, that's right. They're gonna analyze the discussion afterwards and say, no, that wasn't as interesting as we thought it was.
So, Brian, will computers be analyzing this podcast and the words we use at some point in the next month?
I don't know. It depends on how soon you post it. I'll probably run some stuff through it.
You will, but in general, is stuff posted on the web, is it analyzed and for our word usage and things like that?
It can be. Yeah, it can be. And definitely there are companies out there that are very interested in both video and audio content. As a matter of fact, I met with one yesterday around video content and like what's happening within this video. And that's, you know, that's been going on for a very long time. But in terms of, you know, the hardest part for this particular podcast for years has been the speech to text problem. Like, how do I take the words that are spoken, turn them into a word that is written? Because, you know, all the NLP stuff assumes that you have typed out a word at some point. And that has made some really great progresses there's interesting pluralization the computers are going to be mad about. that's made some interesting progress in the last year and a half with the advent of deep learning. That sort of opened up a lot of things that were not as complicated mathematically, but very, very complicated computationally, and allowed us to sort of do a lot better speech-to-text in the last, you know, like I said, year and a half, 2 years maybe.
I have to jump on that as the engineer and owner of the station here. That has been one of the frustrations about podcasting for some time, is that they cannot seem to convert what we're saying into text that the bots and the spiders can read, and therefore then categorize and analyze and whatnot, particularly if you've got more than one speaker in the room. Talk about that.
Absolutely.
But what's the problem with that, and why is so many things we can overcome, why is that still insurmountable?
It's a very good reason, and I've never tried to explain it before. So shut me up if it sounds too geeky, right?
You got 40 minutes. Go.
Go, yeah.
Okay, go, go. So the big problem is that audio is simply audio. It's just a series of waves. And so when you look at a spectrograph, which you are probably doing even as we speak because you're producing the show, when you look at that spectrograph as it goes by, all you see is amplitudes. The first thing you have to do is take that amplitude and convert it to basically a series of sine waves, a series of mathematical waves. And then you have to disentangle the quality of that wave for multiple speakers. You have to say, okay, who was speaking at that moment? Was it Alex? Was it Paul? Was it Brian? And you do that by taking the 500 waves that I'm generating now, compare it to the 500 waves that were being generated a few minutes ago when you were speaking, and try to determine if there is a difference between that sequence of waves. That's sort of essentially a clustering problem. You can do it without clustering, but a lot of people I know do it in some variant of clustering. And that's already hard, like just identifying that the timbre of my voice is slightly different than the timbre of your voice. It's hard for humans even. Last night, I'm a musician. I was playing some Irish music, and there was a
We love you already here. I'm a good Irishman here, so I love you already here.
Well, come down to L.A. We'll play some Irish music.
I'll play the Chieftains here. Okay, all right.
Yes, I was just in Ireland doing, you know, it's a digression. I'll talk about that all day. And now I only have 38 minutes. But last night, as an example, I was sitting, I play tin whistle and Irish banjo. And so I'm sitting here playing the banjo while we're singing a tune. And the guy sitting next to me is singing, and the person across from me could not distinguish what was voice and which was the banjo note. Even though in isolation, those two sounds are very distinct, when they get mixed up with the rest of the sound of the room, it's hard to hear. So the computers have the exact same issue. The room noise is creating things, the us talking back and forth, me coughing, me laughing, I do both of those things frequently, creates this confusion of when is a voice happening, when is a cough happening. And so the first thing you have to do is isolate, is this a word? Is this a cough? Is this a word from the same word, which creates a particular sequence of waves?
So I'm going to ask one last question, then I'm going to shut up on the subject here and let Alex jump back in. But so what you're saying is, I've never thought about this, is that when the computer analyzes voice, it's not listening to it like we do. It's looking at it. It's looking at it as a series of waves. When you edit audio, you edit the wave file. It's literally called a wave file, and it looks like little up and down. It looks like an EKG, little up and down monitoring. So it's looking at that and trying to decipher what's talking, what's noise, what's one person, and it has to isolate those patterns to figure out who's talking and what they're saying. It's not listening; it's looking.
Yes, although I want to get meta on you for a second, because what does looking mean? Like, what we're doing
that's true.
We're getting compression waves in our ears, right? So when we're doing kind of something similar, we're taking an analog signal, and our eardrums are vibrating because that's a compression wave from air. So the computer is like, do you want to call it looking because you can visualize it? Sure, that's cool. Do you want to call it listening? Well, it wouldn't fit our definition because there's no compression wave. Right, so it's like almost like God. Now we're getting all Blade Runner here. You know, it's almost like it's a different sense, right? Like digital perception is almost like its own sense.
Wow!
Wow! All right, you blew my mind. You short-circuited my computer.
Well, but that gets into the computers are analyzing it much different than we are.
Yes.
But they're also taking it all in now. Getting the context of it, is that what they're doing when they're playing Pong? Is contextually, what should it do if this is the situation?
Okay. Yes and no at the same time. I'm becoming an economist all of a sudden. I was having dinner with an economist last night.
I'm sorry.
Off one of his arms, as the saying goes.
The octopus.
yes. On the one hand, on the other hand. So yes and no with context. So in terms of context, if I'm talking about, like you and I are talking about, we were just talking about Irish music, we're talking about in the context of audio signals. Now, some machine learning techniques do try to abstract the concept. Machine learning, AI, to me, it's all the same thing. I know some people are going to, you know, you get hate mail from me saying that, hopefully, somebody. in the context, they sometimes try to identify the context. Frequently, in this one we're talking about with the video game win, really did not look at the context other than the change in the video screen from the last couple of frames. So it would take the differential between, like, oh, when I was looking at the frame a minute ago or a microsecond ago, there was white in the upper left corner. Now there is no white in the upper left corner. I can see that difference. I can take the temporal difference and make a decision on what my next action should be. So that context is like the context is what happened 1 second ago. And that's actually a very mathematically proven technique. If you can make a decision on what you're going to do next based entirely on where you are here or where you just were, like one step ahead, like I'm going to take it one step forward based on the exact square I'm on, or just based on the square I was before and the square I am now, I'm going to take my step. You're now in the realm of what they call Markovian processes, which are mathematically delightful to work with. They're very, very easy.
Not without coffee, though.
Not without coffee. No, I would not recommend you try to do this without coffee. No, there's an old saying. Who was it? Ms. Hilbert, who said, a mathematician is a device for turning coffee into theorems. And I definitely, I try to live up to that credo as best I can.
That's a good quote.
Yeah, I have a lot of them. UCLA has a wall full of great math quotes.
Let's take a little shift here, Brian, and talk about you. Earlier in your career, you did a lot of work with bigger clients, and you helped them do magic tricks with data. Because there's a lot of business leaders out there like, yeah, we're filling up servers, we're putting it in the cloud, but we're not doing anything with our data. We're barely trying to do it. Can you give some examples of how you've done magic tricks with data to help them see something they couldn't see?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to. And many of the, because I used to call myself the mathematical hot jumper. For a while, I was consulting with this company called Greenplum, who sell a relational database, which is like Postgres. And it's a great product. And I acted as their chief scientist. My role was to sort of show up to their really big clients, which I probably should not name, but these are largely Fortune 100, Fortune 500 companies. And I would show up there during the sales cycle and say, hey, you've got all this data. What can you do with it? Right? And it was supposed to be a combination of the database itself, which is a very powerful distributed database, and the analytic packages that had been written for it, one of which I'm proud to say was mine. I had written the first artificial intelligence package for in-database analytics based entirely in SQL. So we had installed that in the Greenplum database. It's called MadLib. Now a full Apache project, by the way. And we would run these AI routines and these ML routines and statistical routines against their data. So that was a very satisfying position because you would literally get a phone call. You know, I live in Los Angeles. I get a phone call at 8 o'clock in the morning. Can you be in Chicago tomorrow? It's like, why do I have to be in Chicago tomorrow? Well, we're meeting with a very large bank. Okay, well, I'll book a ticket. And on the plane ride, they would be like, you have to come up with something exciting about their data. And knowing nothing about their data, you sort of like, okay, now I have to, I have to land, I have to read their database at 8 o'clock in the morning, and then I have to, by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, do a presentation on something they didn't know they had in their data. Extremely exciting, but exhausting sort of position to be in. And one of my favorite tricks that I pulled for this particular large retail chain was the association rules, which is people talk about market basket analysis. The idea if you buy, bread and beer, you're also buying milk. And it's a classic sort of analysis of how people shop and, like, how do you discount and how do you coupon? So if they buy these two things, you want to convince them to buy that third thing because that'll up the value of the basket, which is a fun analysis to do, and it's usually done at a small scale. But we had written this routine that allowed us to do this massive scale. So I get the same phone call I always get. Can you be? I had like 2 days or something, and I showed up in the Midwest. Had to run association. Had to figure out what to do. Right. So the first thing I think is, hey, this is a retail chain. We should do with large baskets. We should do association rules. So this this will get straight to the theme of your show. So we sit down. I have an engineer, a couple engineers working with me, and we pull the data, and I run the routines, and I tune the models, and we get this great convergence, and we go through, and we come up with something that converges in like 26 seconds, which over I don't remember, like 10 million rows of data or something, and it converges in like 26 seconds. So we did it live in the room, and literally the IT department applauded and gasped when it happened. I'm like, I'm going to run it now. I'm like, no way, it's never going to work. You're going to kill yourself. You'll kill us all. I ran it anyway, and it came back in like 26 seconds, and we showed this pattern in their data that they had never seen before about these particular products implying this pair of products implying the purchase of a third product. And they were all delighted until we completely got our bubble burst when one of the marketing analysts said, yeah, but all that data is fake and those are too general. We can't coupon at that point. And I'm like, well, what? You know, just so disappointed. Ta-da, rabbit comes out of the hat. Here's a pattern you didn't know you had in your data, but it's bad data. And so, you know, the theme of your show is like confident ROI. This company had come in, or we had worked with this company, and they had said, we want to do this this sort of analysis with our data, not having the correct data to actually accomplish it. So when we turned around, we said, well, where's the real data? They said, that data doesn't really exist. And so we were completely deflated. We pulled off the trick we were supposed to pull off, but we weren't able to turn around and say, you as a business have the ability to do this for yourselves. We weren't able to do that because they didn't have the data correctly structured in order to do the real market basket rules. So when, you know, data sufficiency studies are extremely important when you're trying to get ROI on data. I just changed the topic entirely. I'm sorry.
That is...
New context.
Well, life isn't linear and business isn't linear. It sounds like data analysis is definitely not linear. You got to go where the data will let you.
Yeah, I'm a highly nonlinear person. Yeah.
So do you have any tips for companies that maybe they're gathering data, they got a lot of interaction with customers, they might not know what they should be analyzing. What can they do to make sure they're capturing something that eventually they can analyze?
It's really about data strategy. I think one of the things since I was doing the 2013, I had a client, I'll illustrate the example of where they had really no strategy in what they wanted to do with data. And I think when you say to people things like data strategy, when Hadoop was the craze, you know, from like 2009 to maybe 2 years ago, data strategy was, we're going to collect everything. We have Hadoop. It doesn't matter. We can fill up our servers full of compressed data. We don't have to index it or anything. But that's not really a strategy. So knowing what you want to do as a business is really a lot about tying it back to what the business wants. I went into this client that was an online lifestyle company back in like 2013, and they were saying, well, you know, we're trying to do, this is not with Green Plum. We're trying to do an analysis of what our user tastes are so we can do recommendations to our users. Very, very common, right? That's done all over the internet right now. People want to recommend, hey, you bought this, you should have that, or maybe you should read this article to create user engagement because everybody wants you to stay on their site longer. So we're sitting down with their tech department and their CEO, and we're going through all the possible things that they could do. They were sort of a liquor-based company. They were focused on adult beverages. And all the different ways that they could present recipes to users, present different combinations of cocktails or things, you know, cheese pairings with that cocktail and such like. And the CTO was telling me about all these great clustering algorithms he's working on. I was like, oh, I've clustered this. These recipes are similar to those recipes. Isn't that neat? Isn't that interesting? And now we just got to figure out how to recommend them. I said, okay, well, great. So when the user logs in, he goes, oh, no, no, we don't have a user login. And I said, well, what do you mean you don't have a user login? He goes, well, we don't have that. I said, well, how are you going to do a personalized recommendation to a completely anonymous person? You know, there's no way to have a recommender if I don't even know your name, and I don't know what you've purchased, and I don't know what you've looked at. And so that was a complete misalignment of sort of tech strategy with corporate strategy. They want to create user engagement. They don't even know who their user is. And I find that mistake is made a lot in businesses. They get excited. The CTO, who can use a lot of big terms, a lot of, you know, impressive words, comes in and says, we have to start using this method, or we have to do deep learning, or we have to do AI. And the CEO says, yeah, I read about that. We have to do that. And so they march off on this endeavor to install all these different routines. They're going to bring in this, they're going to bring in that, without an end goal in mind. And so you end up trying to do user recommendations on non-users. And this is identical in sort of concept to the idea of going into a record with a target. What do I want to know about that patient? what history do I have on this user that will help me inform what I'm going to propose to them. So I think data strategy is probably one of those really overlooked things because it's not really the CTO's job and it's not really the CEO's job. And most people don't know that there's even such a thing as like data strategy. Collect what you want to do, line it up with what you want, the analysis you want to be able to pull off.
Sure. So just to wrap this part up before we go to break, it's important to answer the big questions before you dive in analyzing what's going on the front lines.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah, we see that in a lot of different aspects of business tools, and it looks like it's the same thing. I mean, it really is, what are you looking for, getting back to initially, if we're looking at these kind of patients, or what's the question we're trying to answer, that'll save a lot of time and money and generate the ROI?
Oh, yeah, that's fairly indisputable. And when you say it plainly to people, when you say it in the boardroom, hey, this is what we want to do. We want to know our goals before we embark on something. Everybody agrees with you. But it's very different in practice.
Yeah.
When you try to implement that, you get a lot of blockage.
People want to get going. Like,
yep.
Like Paul, he wants to go to the break. So.
Oh, Paul.
Come on, you know, guys. It's the Irish. Yeah.
Come on, guys. All right. Well, let's take that moment of clarity break and see if we can regroup here. Hang on. Okay, you guys are blowing my mind here today, but I'm going to give you another one that you should consider just as equally mind-blowing. If you're trying to decide what business tool or concept to implement, like we're all doing, because we want to advance our company, but we're thrown thousands and thousands of tools and ideas at us every day, there is a place now. There is a man who can help you, guide you through this. The Sherpa to take you up the mountain of this information and show you the shining horizon that you're looking for. His name is Alex Vorobyev. That's right, Alex Vorobyev, the guy hosting this show. He was the first business advisor to focus on helping companies and leaders find their starting line and the right tool for their situation. Imagine that. Where should I be starting from, and what do I want to use to get me to that next end goal? You can go to Confident ROI with Confidence and learn more, and you can enter your question, a free question. You get a free shot at him. Hey, Vorobyev, just type in your question, and he'll answer you back. Or if you want to be old school, you can call his office at 949-478-0042. That's 949-478-0042. Either way, why don't you check him out and see if he can help you guide through all the sea of tools and skills and whatnot that are coming out. I can't even talk anymore here, guys. You've got me so upset. I'm going to throw it back to you guys here.
Hey, Brian, do you know, have they replaced some of the, on radio, have they replaced some of the hosts and that with...
an artificial intelligence? Yeah, I just need some intelligence here.
I don't think we have.
Oh, I don't. There we go. Bring it back up. Okay, he's on.
Yeah. You were very quiet. You're whispering in my ear like little pixies.
No, we were asking if, has there been any disruption in the radio space with hosts and computerization?
Well,
the ad's better than I was here.
We could try to drive that if you like.
I think it was one of the first areas of disruption, right? Is the disc jockey got replaced?
I think so. You know, it's funny you say that because I got out of real radio a million years ago because I started working for a robot station. And all I'd do is come in and say, that was the Beach Boys, that was the Beatles. And then they'd piece it together into some sort of program. I thought, this isn't radio anymore here.
Yeah.
Now it's satellite radio.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Hey, Brian, let's shift gears a little more here. And
sure.
You're doing what we like to talk with all of our guests about. You're doing a data scientist. At the root of it, you're doing analysis, trying to find conclusions in the data that are supportable.
Yes.
Have you ever seen it where you bring information to leaders that is indisputable, but they don't like the conclusion, and they delay confronting reality, or you delay confronting reality. Any stories you can share? You could change the names to protect the innocent.
Alex, that's never happened in the history of corporate America. The people have refused to accept facts, right? I don't know of any of that ever happening anywhere in the last 72 hours.
Any egregious ones you can think of?
Oh, yeah. So I have a favorite one, a favorite mythology that I came across a long time ago. And So it's hard to disguise who it was, but I want to say who. So I worked for a large internet company that sold ads. One of the things that they would do is they would say to their advertisers, they'd say, okay, you know, we're gonna run your ads. If you pay more for the ads, we're gonna give you better placement. And so why did you want better placement? Because at the time, the model around advertising was basically click-through rate. Like that was actually, click-through rate was still an innovation at the time. It was usually like, I'm going to buy 1,000 impressions, you put them up on your website, and I pay you for the impressions. And then click-through rate became an innovation, you know, 2006 or 7-ish. It would say, if I put up your ads and somebody clicks on it, then you pay me a little bit of cash. And so this company was saying, you pay me more, we'll give you better placement, you'll get better click-through rates. So it came down to what they call the effective price, the effective CPM, the effective cost per million ads, ECPM. If the effective price is higher, if you're paying more, you will have a better click-through rate. They were telling everybody this, and this became part of the folklore of the company. And I was asked, as like one of the chief forecasters, to sort of predict that. Like, how much is it going to be? When I change my ECPM, I want my MBAs to say, you add another 3 cents to your purchase, and you're going to get this better click-through rate. So, okay, fine. You know, I, like everybody, assumed that it was true. I ran a study, and it just proved to be flat-out false. And I came back to the VP of Finance, and I said, this is just not true. The, you know, effective CPM has nothing to do with click-through rate. And they said, no, that's not, that can't be. Go back and look again. So after, you know, arguing with, you know, having the project taken away because I was being difficult, and then them coming back to me and saying, okay, they couldn't find it either. I did this experiment, which is one of, you know, was one of my more fun experiences in corporate America. I took like 60 campaigns. We had had an event where all CPMs were falsely plotted. So basically we had this disruptive event, and I plotted these like 40 to 60 campaigns, and it's somewhere on the plot of their click-through rate, there had been a huge disruption in their ECPM. That was happening as a piece of metadata. So you should be able to look at the plot and find where the CPM changed or the ECPM changed. If this myth was true, like if this hypothesis was true, you should be able to see it right in the charts. If, you know, blood pressure induces heart attack, then you should be able to see blood pressure go up, heart attack happen, things like that. So I tried this, and I literally printed them on paper, distributed them through the entire finance and marketing company. I got about 100 people to respond. And the question is, here are 40 plots. Tell me where there's been a disruption in this time series. And I got like a third of them back, and nobody was correct a single time. So in terms of when that was supposed to happen. And I had some red herrings in there, too, because I'm a good scientist. So I had some, you know, some baseline. Looking at the data, and when I presented the results, I said, look, you are looking at the data. The data does not show any effect of ECPM on click-through rate. So we have to stop telling people that. And, of course, everybody accepted my conclusion as a scientifically valid conclusion, and nobody changed a thing about their pitch.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very frustrating.
So you had the project taken away from you, and they came back to you. And
yes.
And then they didn't change the pitch. And do you find with data analysis, are people really looking for the answer, or are they looking for support for their perspective?
Well, there's a term called confirmation bias for a reason, right? If you're reading through a lot of the journals lately on meta-analysis of research, the phrase confirmation bias comes up again and again and again. So people go looking for what they want to see. That will probably never change. And there's really interesting, I think Stephen Jay Gould does an interesting section on why you are trained to see a face in the jungle, because if you pretend there's a lion out there, if your brain tells you there's a lion out there, you don't lose anything by running away. Finding patterns that don't exist is the human brain sort of natural tendency. The marketing brain and the CEO brain is no different. Finding patterns that confirm what you wanted to say is pretty easy. So, you know, you have to strip them of the answer and say, does this pattern happen here? Does this pattern happen there? Before you can kind of get them to honestly judge what the data says. That's a challenge, you know, because science in general, especially analytics, is not there to please you. It's there to be factual. And so when you're in the role of the guy who is trying to be almost like a lawyer, just sort of judiciously studying every data point and coming to a logical, defensible conclusion, you're almost by nature going to step on toes 50 to 60% of the time.
And that's something that you've grown accustomed to and comfortable with?
Yeah, I think that one of the things, if I can say that I've had any success in this industry, is that I generally can sling a joke once in a while. So when you're walking into a room and you know you're going to tell them that their click-through rate model is all crap, you have to do it in a funny way. And that reduces barriers.
It goes down better. You get a return on that humor.
Yes. At least I feel like I have, but I'm sure there are thousands of people across the United States who would disagree with my ability to do that. maybe even many of your listeners at this very moment.
So you don't go Dr. Spock on them or Spock on them?
No, I mean, I try not to. I think that ultimately, no matter how good your science is, the human interaction, the sort of societal part of running a business, of collecting data, of doing analysis, still exists. And one of the crises that AI is facing right now is twofold. One is that there are all these irreproducible results out there where people have done image classification, and then people can't do it again because the researcher who did the study wasn't thorough enough in his study, and so he claims a result that he doesn't actually have. So when somebody else comes along and says, hey, I'm going to try that, and I'm going to do it twice, it doesn't work. That is one problem facing AI right now and what might be leading us to another AI winter. And the other one is that it's just really hard to market soft assurances. It's hard for IBM Watson to say, hey, we think we can help. They have to say, we can help. We're going to definitively solve this problem. Because people's expectations are that you are going to have an absolute answer. One example of that, when I was working with the government, we were working with the National Archives, and we wanted to do document classification. We wanted to say, this document is about Paris. This document is about patent law. And the National Archives wanted humans to review every document. They said, well, that's simply not scalable. Let a computer do it. And they said, well, computers might be inaccurate. And I said, well, you know that humans are inaccurate on this, 37% of the time. I don't remember. The number was somewhere around 35 to 40, where humans are wrong about it, or humans disagree. It's easy to say a computer should have a perfect answer, but a human can have a flawed answer, because people don't understand that, the information that goes between the human systems and the computer systems is already inherently flawed. That's where I start talking cybernetics, so I should probably back off on that.
Well, we're kind of coming to the end here, Brian. And if you could share with business leaders, business owners, that they got a business, they're not a Fortune 100 business, what type of tools out there they should be on their radar that they could get a return on their investment that should be there and them thinking about?
I think that it's twofold. I think that definitely from a technology perspective, you want a good BI tool. They're not sexy, but
and
getting
that's,
a good
what's BI?
Well, it's like a business intelligence tool, something like MicroStrategies or Tableau. If you want to be really corporate, you want Oracle, something that will handle all of your financial data, handle all your sales data, some place to put all your data as it comes in. So every time a sale is recorded, it has to go someplace, and then be able to generate a visual report against that in your business intelligence department. So how does the CEO know how many sales we have? He gets to go to a dashboard every day. That stuff is valuable even at a very small level. And so I think people often overlook that, thinking, oh, we don't really need BI yet. And I disagree. But I think the other half of that is a good data strategy, is being able to know, what do I want to know from my data? What do I want to be able to do? What kinds of, and that comes back from, what kinds of decisions do I want to be able to make next quarter? Do I want to make a decision about a go, no-go on a product? Well, then I better start collecting data on products. Do I want to make a decision about, hiring and firing? You better collect data on your hiring and firing. And people think that they're going to just ingest all this data, and then they're going to be able to answer these questions, but without a strategy around how they're going to collect that data and at what granularity are they going to collect that data, they're really not doing themselves any favors.
Okay. And so the key is for them to start answering those big questions and having something like a BI tool that's starting to harness or sort the data and make it usable?
Yes, absolutely. And I would say that And this is slightly self-serving, but I think that you need to have somebody, a third party, come in and talk to you about strategy. We just talked about confirmation bias, and it's no less prevalent in business. It's probably more prevalent in business than it is in any academic research institution. So having somebody come in and say, you know, this is what I think you should do is really, really valuable. Even just a friend or a high-paid consultant, but somebody else has to help you with your strategy.
And is that something you – I know you're working on your next venture. Is that something you help people find the right person or point them in the right direction?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I do it as a hobby at this right around now. but, yeah, if people have questions about that, I'm happy to answer them. And contact information below, I expect.
All right. We'll put the contact information below. Anything else you'd like to share with the audience?
I really enjoyed this conversation. I didn't expect that I'd have such diarrhea of the mouth, but that's happened to me before, so I should have expected that. That's an absence of pattern recognition.
It was a great conversation. I'm glad we met at the USC function and you were able to come on today. And so we're going to turn it over to Paul while we still have a human running the show. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you, guys.
You've been listening to Confident ROI, the one show you can confidently listen to get a real return on your investment. Brought to you by Alex Vorobyev and the magazine ConfidentROI.com.